Chapter 3. The Firebringers. The vast distance between stars was often likened to an ocean by those with more poetry in them than practicality. Fulgrim thought the comparison apt. The remaining oceans on Chemos were all but empty of life, despite his best efforts, as was the void. The black between the stars was as lifeless as those grey waters, and as cold. But like those waters, there was life of sorts in its depths. Hungry life. Cruel life. He could feel the reverberations of the hull plates in his marrow as the pride of the Emperor burned itself a path through the deep waters of the Empyrean. He could hear the faint screams of the astropathic choirs in the depths of his mind. They dreamed terrible dreams as the ship's navigator sought a safe course. Precious weeks were lost to the slow navigation of the anti-reality. But it could not be rushed. It must be done perfectly or not at all, something Fulgrim appreciated despite his frustration at the inevitable delays. Still, a crude business, warp travel. Inefficient. Imperfect. Perhaps one day he might turn his mind to improving it. For now, Fulgrim had other, more immediate concerns. He weighed the sword in his hand, considering. Then he spun with an almost languid motion, letting the blade carry him where it would. Fireblade, like all good weapons, had a mind of its own. There was something of its maker in it, a filament of anger, ever pulsing, waiting to be unsheathed and set into motion. The artist and the art were often inseparable, and there was always something of the one in the other, regardless of intent. He laughed to himself, remembering Ferris's look of incomprehension when he tried to explain it. His silver-limbed brother had an instinctive grasp of machinery, from the most primitive clockwork to the most advanced cogitating systems. But art was beyond him, or so he claimed. Fulgrim suspected that Ferris Manus's creativity ran deeper than he thought. "We are wells yet untapped," Fulgrim murmured. A saying of Horace's. They all had their secrets, their hidden passions. What was a man but a tangle of secrets? Not that they were men, but demigods were as entitled to secrets as the mortals who worshipped them. He flinched back from the thought. Worship was a taboo word in his father's kingdom. There was no worship, for there were no gods, no demigods, only the Emperor and his sons, and the Imperium they would rule together. He fell into an easy rhythm, moving in loose circles about his private quarters. Every circle was a dance step and an attack in one. He had learned the war rhythms from the Sulphur in his youth. The Sulphur tribes had produced preeminent swordsmen and not much else. They'd been nomads, and they'd believed that the only fit occupations for men were making war and dancing. Two things they did quite well. He stopped, falling out of the rhythm instantly. The Sulphur had been broken at his command. All that remained of them now were the lessons he'd learned in his time with them. They had been the last obstacle to his control of Chemos. A wild folk, unable to adapt to changing times, they had threatened the perfection he'd envisioned. And so, he had destroyed them, one clan at a time, tribe by tribe. Some few Sulphur remained, scattered throughout the Legion, but as a culture, they were nothing more than one memory amongst many. Still holding Fireblade extended, both hands tight about the hilt, Fulgrim bowed his head. "I'm sorry," he murmured. He closed his eyes. The obliteration of the Sulphur had been a necessary evil. That didn't make the weight any easier to bear, however. He sometimes wondered what would have happened had he been found by such a primitive folk, rather than a downtrodden pair of factory workers. Would he have been more like Russ, or even Horace? Perhaps that might have been better. For them, imperfection was somehow turned into strength. He turned swiftly, letting the blade slide through his hands. It caught the light and sheared through it, casting reflected shards in every direction. Corin and Tullia had been capable parents at best. Life in the fortress factory of Kallax had broken them early, and they withered, even as he flourished. He rotated his wrists, angling the blade, and brought it around until it extended towards an isolated nook where two small plinths stood. Atop each plinth was a bust, one of Corin and one of Tullia. Plain marble with no colour or gilt to distinguish them, almost identical in their expressions of weary acceptance. It was hard to tell which was which at times, even for him.
"You did the best you could," he said softly in benediction.
Their imperfections had been no fault of their own. He spun on his heel, drawing the sword up in a savage cut. He had taken control of Kallax within a few months of being put to work there. Chemos had been dying then, its mines tapped, its ores plundered. Civilization faltered, crumbling at the edges. The Sulphur had not been alone in their primitivism, merely the largest group. He remembered those first fierce brawls against the cannibal tribes inhabiting factories gone cold many centuries past, the doomed expedition to Deep Processor One, and the monstrous thing he'd faced on the Forble board. For 50 years, he had waged war against the inevitable, and on the day he'd won it, he'd learned that his war was nothing more than a skirmish in a far greater conflict, that his light was but one of many, gleaming in a darkness more pervasive than he'd imagined. The Emperor had come to Chemos and illuminated the Illuminator. He had set the Phoenix's nest aflame so that Fulgrim might be reborn into a new and greater existence. But already that existence was threatened, both within and without. He had made enemies merely by existing. He was used to that. On Chemos, he had been forced to navigate spheres of influence as he slowly worked to break down and rebuild the old executive clan system. Like a machine that had outlived its purpose, the system had caused more problems than it solved. It was the same here, though on a much grander scale. A new bureaucracy was being born to maintain the territories taken in the Great Crusade, and that bureaucracy had little love for elements outside its control. His brothers didn't see it yet. Horus, perhaps, had an inkling. But Fulgrim had grown to manhood among such mechanisms of influence. He recognized them instantly, and the subtle danger they could pose. That danger was but one reason among many, that the Third must come into its own, and sooner rather than later. His sons had been spent like bolt rounds in his absence. A few here, a few there, but it all added up. The mathematics of attrition were inescapable, and broken tools were soon replaced. He would not let that happen to his sons, to his legion. They would grow in strength to rival the legions of his brothers. The galaxy would be reminded of why they alone, of all the Emperor's sons, bore the Palatine Aquila. And it would begin with Byzas. He would conquer with 6 blades, where his brothers might need 1,000. Their superiority and his would be undeniable then. A blurt of sound from the Vox system caught his ear.
"My lord, we are entering orbit over 28-1,
Abdomon said, his voice shrouded in static. Fulgrim lowered his sword.
"Understood. Assemble the others in the disembarkation bay. I will meet you there shortly."
He sheathed Fireblade with a flourish and turned to bow to the busts of his foster parents. Fulgrim smiled. The ascent commences. As the pride of the Emperor transitioned into orbit, primary iterator Golconda Pike felt the old familiar sense of excitement. The game was set to begin, and she could not wait to make her first move. It had been some time since her last outing, Compliance was often established at spear point these days. Once it had been a carefully choreographed dance of minds, pushing and pulling against one another. Now the Great Crusade was a sea of iron, rolling over any shore that defied it. But every sea had its limit. Soon diplomacy would again be in vogue, though she feared she would be too old to enjoy it by then. It was no longer a game for people like her. It now belonged to younger iterators, with smooth voices and moderate opinions. She glanced down at her hands. They were unlined, despite her age. She allowed few cracks in her facade, and those only for appearance. She had never been lovely, but careful application of age lent her beauty. The rejuvenation treatments that kept her in fighting trim would soon reach a point of diminishing returns. She had decided to lean into the curve and descend into obsolescence gracefully. After all that she had accomplished, she felt she had earned it. Pike looked up. The disembarkation bay was staggering in its immensity. Armies were meant to assemble in its cathedral-like interior, and waiting stormbirds sat in ranks of three, wings folded. But there was no army here today, only a collection of musicians and a motley assortment of influential faces. The hum of many conversations warred with the music in the cavernous space. It was a dolorous composition, and one she only vaguely recognised. Something from Chemos, she supposed, given the origins of the musicians. A drab little world, with equally sombre music. She listened politely for a time and gestured for her hangers-on to applaud at the appropriate moments. Her popinjays, as Abdomon liked to call them, were mostly camouflage. Bright plumage, loud voices, silly opinions. They served to distract the unimportant and the foolish, so that she could see to things unhindered. They were more subdued than normal. Not unexpected, given the oppressiveness of their surroundings. Even her pet killers were nervous, though only someone who'd been around them as long as she had could tell. Nervous or not, she felt better for having them close to hand. Diplomacy was a funny business. You never knew when you might need someone disposed of, efficiently and swiftly. A few bodies were always conducive to negotiations. Pike studied the other members of the delegation. There were 100 of them in all, lesser iterators, administratum bureaucrats, and military officers of various ranks and privileges. There were a few roguish sorts as well, men and women with warrants of trade, looking to secure economic or political ties with a newly compliant world. They were all the invisible cogs of the machine that was the Great Crusade. Wars might be won by big guns, but someone had to requisition the ammunition. And someone else had to ensure that the guns and the ammunition both got made. Thousands upon thousands of moving parts, all acting in concert to one man's will. She nodded politely to those worth the gesture and safely ignored the rest. Of those, only Herodotus Fraser seemed insulted. The current Lord Commander of the Archite Palatines had a high opinion of his strategic acumen, and was put out that she didn't share it. He was also of the opinion that compliance was best achieved by the sword, and that anyone not wearing a uniform ought to stay out of it. Grey-haired and thickly built, Fraser was more scar tissue than man, and, like her, on the cusp of his last decade in service. Word around the palace was that his replacement, a keen young officer named Fail, was impatiently waiting for Fraser to hurry up and retire, or die. Fraser seemed inclined to do neither. Pike sighed and turned an idle eye to the stormbirds. She'd been around military transports often enough to recognise when they'd seen too much action and too little maintenance. But they were functional, and several waited on the launch rails, wings extended. The heavy dropships were capable of both void and atmospheric flight, which made them useful for depositing murderous, genetically augmented killing machines as close to the enemy as possible, or for transporting diplomatic envoys looking to make a very definite impression on their hosts.
It was an adroit reminder to the inhabitants of Byzas as to what awaited them should they not agree with Fulgrim's terms. What it lacked in subtlety, it made up for in effectiveness. Given what she knew of the military capabilities of the continental government of Byzas, 10 of the gunships could pound them flat. 3 were enough to make a point. She hoped they'd take the hint, if only for the sake of the vineyards. The deck trembled beneath her feet, and the musicians abandoned their dirge for something a bit livelier. The Phoenician and his sons approached. Abdomon led the way, one hand resting on the pommel of his sword, the other holding his helmet. His dark face was set and serious. Behind him, in loose formation, came the 6 legionaries chosen by Fulgrim. She marked them off her mental checklist as they approached. Sirius, Alkanex, Quinn, Thorn, Telmar, and following a step behind, the spider himself. While the others wore armour as ornate as it was sturdy, and moved with the lethal grace of stalking predators, Fabius's war gear was unadorned and plain, and he stumped along with resigned determination. The only piece of equipment that had seen more care than absolutely necessary was the twitching Medicae harness he wore. Its limbs and their assortment of blades, saws, and syringes gleamed eerily. Then she had the distinct unwelcome impression that it was somehow aware of her scrutiny. Her unease was forgotten as Fulgrim entered the bay. He cut a magnificent figure, she had to admit, clad in amethyst-coloured armour trimmed in gold, with a long, scaled cloak of emerald green. He looked like a hero from some ancient myth cycle. The weapons he carried only enhanced that image. On one hip, Fireblade, the sword forged by the silver hands of a loving brother. On the other, Firebrand, a Volkite charger that more resembled a work of art than a tool of death. The armour, she knew, was designed so as to give free rein to his inhuman agility. Sensible, given that he was the fastest of the Emperor's sons, by all accounts, capable of movements that the human eye simply could not track. His pale, symmetrical features were framed exquisitely by a high collar of purple, and the great stylized eagle's wings sweeping up from his chest plate over his left shoulder. Violet eyes, as deep as galactic wells, scanned the faces of those gathered in the bay, noting and fixing each in that incredible memory. Her face was saved for last. An honour, perhaps, or maybe a challenge. Either way, she stepped forward to meet it, as was her duty as primary iterator. She bowed respectfully, making a professional attempt to hide the bother it caused her. Great age came with great discomfort.
My Lord Fulgrim, you honour us with your presence.
Primary iterator Pike, a delight to see you again, Fulgrim said, bowing low over her. Pike fought the familiar, almost overwhelming urge to fall to her knees as she looked up into those impossibly pristine features. She'd met Primarchs before, and even berated one, an event she suspected had used up her quota of luck for the century. More than that, she had bent entire planets to her will with one well-placed word. Purely in terms of conquest, she ranked high among the warlords of the Great Crusade, though few would admit it. Perhaps that was why Fulgrim had agreed to her request so many months ago to join the 28th Expedition. Then, maybe it was simply that they'd been without a proper iterator for some time. There was more potential for advancement with the other expeditions, but Pike was beyond such concerns at this late stage in her life. Fulgrim turned, letting his gaze sweep over the others. He greeted them all by name and spent a few moments with each, some longer than others. Through it all, Pike watched him, weighing his worth, seeing if what she'd heard was true. Each of the Emperor's sons was different. Some were, to put it bluntly, more human than others. Fulgrim was at once both human and not, like a statue given life, but with a purpose all its own. A purpose that had only become more focused in the intervening centuries since his rediscovery. A purpose almost, but not quite, not yet, at odds with the needs of the Imperial Army. As if aware of her thoughts, Fulgrim glanced at her, over the head of Lord Commander Fraser. He was not a fool. He knew whom she truly reported to. She'd made little effort to hide it, seeing no need. Best to have all such things out in the open. Kept hidden, they only threatened to trip one up at the most inopportune times. At last he turned back towards her, and once again bowed deeply.
"I trust Abdomon has seen to your needs adequately on the journey?
My apologies for absenting myself, but there was much to be done in preparation for our grand endeavour."
"No apologies necessary, I assure you. We were well looked after."
Fulgrim smiled, and Pike felt her heart twitch. It was as if he were a sun caged in flesh. Every smile, every laugh, was a flare of light and heat, striking to the very core of her. She would have to be careful around him, more so, perhaps, than she had been around the others. Like the sun, he might reduce her to cinders and never notice.
"I would like you to accompany me personally," he said. "I feel it best that we present a unified front, militarily and diplomatically. Herodotus agrees, don't you, Herodotus?"
"You are in overall command, my lord,"
Fraser said, glaring daggers at Pike. Was he jealous, perhaps? The thought amused her. She smiled prettily at him, and was rewarded by a twitch of his eye.
"Lovely."
If Fulgrim noticed the exchange, he gave no sign. He extended his hand to her in a courtly gesture. Gingerly, she took it. This close, she could feel the weight of his strength. Here was a being who could tear mountains apart with his bare hands, or swim through seas of boiling metal. It didn't bear thinking about what he could do to her, if he so chose. Despite that, his touch was light. She recalled how carefully Abdomon had held her wineglass, and wondered if the whole world were like that for Fulgrim.
"Come, we shall take my personal vessel."
He gestured towards one of the stormbirds. Its wings had a larger span than that of its fellows, and they were curved in a graceful backward sweep. Its prow had been modified to a hooked point, in contrast with the blunt snouts of the other vessels. Fulgrim preened slightly as she and Fraser made appropriately appreciative noises.
"I designed and constructed her myself in the Armorium decks. She is the fastest gunship in the expeditionary fleet." "Is that important?"
Pike asked. Fulgrim laughed.
"Only to me."
He led her towards the waiting gunship with stately aplomb. The assembled musicians began to play a slow, dignified piece. The music was tinged with melancholy, a hint of parting and sweet sorrows. Fulgrim apparently preferred it to the more triumphal arrangements common to these moments.
"I confess some curiosity as to the nature of your preparations, Lord Fulgrim."
"I was reading the histories and works your people procured from 28-1.
"All of them?"
Pike was startled, though she hoped it didn't show on her face.
"There were over 8,000 separate volumes of history alone."
The people were literate, almost egregiously so. Whatever could be written down was.
"And 5,000 volumes of verse, most of which was concerned with rather tawdry agrarian imagery."
Pike laughed.
"Yes, they do rather overestimate the appeal of bucolic activities, don't they?"
She glanced up at him.
"And what did you learn from your studies?"
"There's a vast gulf between poetry and reality."
Fulgrim frowned.
"Their dynastic system is beyond salvaging. There will be open revolt in one generation, perhaps two. The limited technological knowledge base left to them after Old Night is already degrading. In 10 generations, they'll be barbarians. In 15, barely human at all."
"But for the moment, they're united under a semi-stable, if autocratic, government."
Pike patted his hand in an almost motherly fashion. His armour was warm to the touch.
"And we can work with that."
"I hope so," Fulgrim said, glancing down at her.
"I am magnificent, but even I cannot fight a whole world on my own."
He smiled. "Though the temptation to try is almost overwhelming, I admit." Pike eyed him as they reached the gunship's boarding ramp. Was that a joke or a warning? It was hard to tell with Fulgrim.
One word in the right ear is sharper than 1,000 swords.
And even a blunt blade can kill, Fulgrim gestured. Our chariot awaits. The Firebird hurled itself into the void with a shriek of engines. Two more Stormbirds followed it, carrying the remainder of the delegation. Interceptors fanned out around the gunships in a loose formation. It was more for show than anything else, an empty gesture to an inattentive audience. Fulgrim and the others sat in a section of the Firebird's crew compartment, reserved for Fulgrim and his immediate subordinates. The roaring of the engines was only a dim rumble here, muted by a special baffle field he'd designed as a boy. The field's original purpose had been to protect the ears of deep ore hauler crews on Chemos from the noise of their engines, but he'd adapted it for use in the Firebird easily enough. The internal facings of the command compartment were decorated with delicately crafted mosaics depicting representative scenes from the history of the Legion. One scene in particular drew Fulgrim's eye. The Proximan betrayal. A defining moment for his sons, and one he'd missed. Insurrectionists, armed with a vortex weapon, had almost killed the Emperor during the Proxima compliance ceremonies. Only the efforts of the Legion's 16th cohort and the Legio Custodes had enabled the Emperor to escape the trap the rebels had laid for him. They had bought his life with their blood and died to a man. The remainder of the Legion had made Proxima pay for the insult, eventually burning the planet to its bedrock from orbit. The Emperor's children had earned the right to bear the Palatine Aquila for their efforts on Proxima. Another honour earned without him. Another victory built on the bones of dead legionaries. Dead warriors who might not have died had he been there. Fulgrim glanced at Abdomon and the others, farther back in the compartment, wondering which of them might soon join the dead. Perhaps not now, but later. Death was an inevitability no legionary could resist. He quashed the thought before it could go any further. To contemplate inevitability was to surrender to it, and he had never been guilty of that. Sometimes he dreamed of Proxima, of Luna and Jupiter, battles where a Primarch might have made a difference, where the Phoenician might have led his sons to less costly victories. But such dreams were folly, and worse. To gnaw at the past was to threaten the foundation of the future. Best to let it lie and get on with the work ahead. He activated the hololithic projector set into the compartment fixtures. A flickering representation of 28-1 sprang into being before him. He'd installed the hololith in order to better adapt his battle strategies to changing information on the ground. If one was to excel, no detail was too small to consider. Byzas hung lonely and silent in the void, accompanied only by a single permanent natural satellite. A telluric planet, ringed by a somnolent, high-density debris belt, it was the only planet in its system capable of sustaining terrestrial life unaided. Fulgrim studied the hololithic image of the system, accessing the data packets compiled by the early-stage explorator teams. The debris belt around the planet had once played host to extensive ferric ore extraction facilities, but those had long since gone dark. The lunar colonies had been given over to a similar purpose, but their extraction rate had fallen well below the average, due to the increased pressures of subsistence production. The continental government still had access to a small fleet of ancient interstellar craft, three, according to the explorators, and one had been in dry dock for a century. The remaining two were only rarely unleashed from their decrepit orbital docks in order to transport materials and prisoners to the lunar colonies. Fulgrim tapped the hololith, narrowing the scope of study. Byzas was singularly unlovely. Even at a distance, he could see the scars of atomic warfare stretching across the southern continent. There was a reason the Emperor had all but banned such weapons. An irradiated planet was a useless planet, save to the drones of the Mechanicum. Another tap brought up a recording of the faint Fox transmissions emanating from the planet's surface, barely powerful enough to reach past the debris belt, another indication of rapid technological decline. Fulgrim banished the flickering ribbons of static. "Entropy in action," he murmured, as he returned to his study of the planet. "That orbital docking ring will succumb completely in a decade or less. The lunar colonies will be cut off and isolated. Some will perish in a few months, others will linger for years before finally going dark. An unpleasant fate."
"One that can be prevented," Pike said.
Fulgrim glanced at her. The primary iterator sat next to him, nearly swallowed up by her grav harness.
"But not easily."
"No," she admitted. "But then nothing worth doing is ever easy."
She reached out and tapped the hololith, refocusing it.
"The Continental Government is relatively stable, thanks to an entrenched bureaucracy and several decades' worth of momentum. Remove a cog, the machine will continue to function. But the more pieces you strip out, the more erratic that function becomes, and the more necessary it becomes to have a steady hand in control."
"Which it doesn't,"
Fraser spoke up. The commander of the Arkite Palatines sat across from them, alongside several of his junior officers. He stared at the hololith as if planning a planetary assault, which, Fulgrim supposed, they were, in a way.
"Not currently," Pike said. "Once the slack could have been picked up by the other members of the gubernatorial triumvirate. 4 generations ago, there were 3 continental governors and a united planetary government. Now there's just the one. Hereditary governor Pandion IV, and a sorry specimen he is as far as autocrats go," Pike smiled. "Which is to our benefit, I suppose."
Fulgrim nodded. The gubernatorial triumvirate had been bloodily dissolved in the last set of planetary civil wars. The end result had been full-scale atomic immolation of the southern continent and the capitulation of the westernmost. There was only one continent now, Chalcodon, where before there had been 3. Was it the result of necessity or negligence? Perhaps it didn't matter.
"And he's just welcoming us with open arms, is he?"
Fraser sounded doubtful.
"I've never yet met one of these backwater tyrants who wasn't looking for a fight."
"Well then, this will be an education for you," Pike said.
Fraser flushed but held his tongue. Rumours about the primary iterator abounded. Some claimed she had the ear of the Emperor himself. Fulgrim knew better. She was one of the Sigilites' creatures in all but name. Malkador was keeping tabs on him, as he did all of the Primarchs, watching them, judging them, as if seeking out the means by which they might be humbled. An uncharitable thought, perhaps, but true so far as Fulgrim could see. How his father could trust such a creature was a mystery to Fulgrim. Then trying to understand his father's reasons for anything was like grasping sand. The harder you tried, the more it slipped through your fingers. In the end, you knew less than you did before you began. The Emperor was at once remote and ever-present, an enigma, unable to fully shrink himself to fit the preconceptions of his sons. And why should he have to? The Emperor was perfection itself, the ideal made flesh. If Fulgrim was the phoenix, then the Emperor was the fire that bestowed renewal. The Emperor did not lower himself to meet the expectations of lesser beings. So why should his sons? Why must the phoenix prove himself to those who might otherwise be prey to his beak and talons? Why must the Illuminator explain himself to the ignorant? Some among his brothers maintained that it was a necessary humbling. They waged war not for their own sake, but in the name of all mankind. But mankind had shown itself time and again to be a frail thing, prone to bending with the wind. Chemos had been a fruit rotting on the vine until he had taken it in hand. Byzas was the same. And like Chemos, Byzas would never truly belong to him. Was he destined to be a gardener who never enjoyed the fruits of his own labour? This morose line of contemplation was broken by an announcement from the flight deck.
"Final approach in 10,
the pilot said, his voice crackling through the compartment's vox system. Fulgrim deactivated the hololith. They were passing through the debris field. He could hear the Firebird's engines whining in protest as the pilots navigated the belt. Fulgrim sighed and tapped the restraint of his grav harness. The deck rolled beneath his feet as he stood. At his gesture, Abdomon and the others did the same.
"So, we come to it, my sons," he said, his voice carrying easily over the dim roar of the engines. "The beginning of our Anabasis. But a word or two of warning before we begin. These people have never seen your like. Do not allow their awe to lull you into a false sense of your own invulnerability."
He looked around.
"You are demigods, but even demigods can die. By the same token, do not expect them to fully comprehend your capabilities."
He fixed Sirius with a stern gaze and raised a finger in warning.
"No duels."
Sirius's face was unreadable beneath his helmet, but the slight twitch of his head showed that he'd heard, at least. Abdomon had informed Fulgrim of Sirius's encounter with Pike's pet killers. An error in judgment, whatever his reasons. He nodded, satisfied.
"We are as the fire bringers of legend, my sons. We come to raise up the masses and cast aside the shadows of their ignorance. Act accordingly."
He turned back to Pike.
"Will you allow me to act as your escort, primary iterator?"
Pike looked up at him.
"Of course, my lord. It would be my pleasure."
The compartment rocked slightly. He could hear the change in the engines, signalling atmospheric entry. His heart sped up in anticipation. Despite himself, he was excited. This was the last great test, and he was determined to pass it.
"Touching down in 5, 4, 3, 2.
The roar of the thrusters became muted and finally fell silent. Pike and the other senior members of the delegation freed themselves from their grav harnesses. Fulgrim pulled his golden eagle-winged helmet on. It latched into place with a hiss, and sensor readouts blinked into view before his eyes.
"Open the hatch,"
he said. The Firebird's crew compartment was filled with a watery light as the hatch cycled open. A roar of noise accompanied the light. Cheering voices mingled with the blare of triumphal music. Fulgrim smiled and held out his hand to Pike.
"We shall disembark last, I think, if you've no objections."
Pike laughed.
"A bit of theatre never hurts in these situations, I've learned."
Abdomon and the warriors of the Third were the first to disembark. The Space Marines, led by Abdomon, tromped down the ramp, bolters held across their chests, moving in perfect synchronization. All save Fabius, who followed them, the limbs of his Medicaid harness unfurling like the petals of some abominable flower as he cleared the bulkhead. Fulgrim activated his armor's sensor link and connected to the pict feed of Abdomon's helmet, allowing him to see what the Lord Commander saw. The trio of Stormbirds had landed on a massive, flatstone dais, many hundreds of meters across. Broken support structures lined its edges, their irregular, rusting shapes strung with thick garlands of some pale, plump blossom. A jubilant sea of faces surrounded the dais, filling the immense plaza it occupied. Structures crowded the plaza on all sides, but the dais was taller than any of them. Fulgrim realized that it was actually the foundation of an ancient landing platform, and that the buildings around it had been built much later. Through the picked feed of their helmets, Fulgrim watched as his sons automatically spread out in a loose stichos formation, placing themselves between the Firebird and those waiting to greet its passengers.
"Sirius Pan left," Fulgrim murmured, as he cycled through the various feeds.
Sirius obliged, and Fulgrim got his first look at the rulers of Byzas. A small crowd of dignitaries waited a safe distance from the Firebird. They wore thick robes of state beneath gaudy encrustations of jewellery he suspected were used to denote function and rank.
A line of continental government troops, in blue uniforms and segmented lobster-shell breastplates, stood at parade rest behind the dignitaries. The soldiers appeared to be armed with a variety of low-velocity, bolt-action rifles. The cheers of the crowd had ebbed as they got their first look at the towering forms of the Space Marines. It swelled once more as Fraser led his junior officers down the ramp. The Arkite Palatines were human, at least, if a trifle exotic. The crowd of dignitaries jerked into motion and Fulgrim chuckled. Pike glanced up at him.
What is it?
They think Fraser is me. She snorted.
They're in for a shock.
Well, best to get it over with then, I suppose. Fulgrim escorted her to the hatchway, and they paused there. The Byzant dignitaries froze halfway to the Firebird, and then milled about like startled birds as Fulgrim and Pike descended. Silence fell across the plaza, and Fulgrim felt a small thrill of pleasure. The awe of humans was a heady thing. He and Pike descended in stately fashion. She looked like a child next to him. The silence stretched for long moments, until at last a slim figure stepped forward. A younger man, wearing a seal of state around his neck, and dressed in more sombre hues than the rest. He hesitated only a moment, before prostrating himself before Fulgrim.
My lord Phoenician, it is my honour to welcome you to Nova Basilos. I am Chancellor Corinth of the Continental Government of Chalcodon A. Byzas, and I extend to you the hospitality of the gubernatorial throne and all the protections and rights thereof.
He straightened, a weak grin on his face.
Though, having now seen you up close, we might as well dispense with the protections bit.
Fulgrim smiled, and the Chancellor blanched. He stumbled, and Fulgrim steadied him easily.
I happily welcome your protection, most honourable Chancellor, and your hospitality both. I am Fulgrim, and I come bearing tidings of peace and prosperity.
His voice echoed across the platform like the rumble of soft thunder. He looked up, scanning the ranks of assembled dignitaries, fixing their faces in his mind.
I come in the name of the Emperor of all mankind, Lord of Terra and all known space, to welcome Byzas and all its peoples at last into the Imperium of Man. Long have we dreamed of this reunion, and much happiness may it bring us both.
He folded his hands over his chest and bowed slightly to the hereditary governor and his family. As he straightened, the crowd began to cheer. The assembled nobility, on the other hand, looked anything but pleased. He noted the deepest frowns, filing them away for later consideration. The initial negotiations of any planetary compliance were the most important. In the next few days, the Continental Government would learn the new limits of its autonomy, as well as how much face it could expect to save during the necessary compliance ceremonies. This was often the time that revolts were conceived, as former power brokers found themselves suddenly bereft of influence and importance. Fulgrim waved to the masses, never letting his smile slip. He was the face of the Imperium, benevolent, welcoming, gentle. On Chemos, treachery was just another weapon in the executive arsenal. Deals were made and broken as easily as breathing. The key, as with anything, was timing. From what he'd read, it was much the same here, though in a more ritualized form. Honor was a fluid concept here, as on Chemos. An oath to a fool was no oath at all. The only true consequences were those you couldn't adapt to. He hoped the governor and his people proved themselves adaptable, but if not, he would show them the iron fist that hid beneath the velvet glove. He would break Byzas to his will, one way or another. The 28th expedition would succeed, and a renewed Third Legion would rise from the ashes of the old.